Anyway, what were the two reasons why the British Empire fell? Two things connected, and they are the major reasons why, in the last 500 years, every preeminent power has fallen. Before Britain, it was France. Before France, it was who? Who was the greatest power before France? Spain. Okay. So you look at the last 500 years, it has been these two things together. Even, in fact, before Spain, it was Portugal. In the early 1400s, Portugal, exactly the same thing. The two primary reasons. Nathan?
They were wary of paying the cost of having an empire.
Okay, there's an expression I'm looking for. Imperial overstretch, or imperial overreach is what it's called. And that is where you have extensive military obligations all over the world, and in effect you're overextended militarily. And of course the cost of paying for all of that leads to borrowing, and that borrowing gets out of hand. And those two things together have caused the problem. Let's look at the map again of the British Empire and the United States, if we can get that on the screen. I may need you, I'm not sure exactly. Okay, wait a second. No, we need to go back. There it is. Okay, thank you. All right, you look at this map of the British Empire and the United States. You see how Britain had to defend all of that. Britain had the biggest navy in the world, and this empire, which had begun in the early 1600s, by the middle of the 1900s, the British just had too many military commitments. And after fighting two world wars, they were weakened considerably. Now, it's interesting, by the way, to see what weakened them the most. Because after World War I, the British were given control of large parts of the Middle East by the League of Nations. Look at this map here. You'll see some familiar places. Everything colored red there was British, a part of the British Empire. Now, Britain already had control of Egypt and Sudan, and also Cyprus. But after the First World War, the Turkish Empire collapsed, and Britain acquired those other areas colored red. Iraq, for example, Palestine, which is now Israel, also Transjordan, all came under British rule. And in 1920, when the British took over Iraq, they had major problems because the Iraqis didn't like it, and it led to a World War I, really needed a break from military commitments, and instead they found themselves in a conflict in Iraq. Where are we right now? So Britain was borrowing from America from 1916 on, and at the end of World War I, really needed a break from military commitments, and instead they found themselves in a conflict in Iraq. Where are we right now? In Iraq, okay? Very similar situation, actually, because the British made the mistake when they went into Iraq of trying to rule it directly, found they couldn't. After losing 500 men, roughly 500, the British then decided the best thing to do was to give Iraq its own government and then try to manipulate things behind the scenes, which is exactly what we're trying to do. We've repeated exactly the same mistakes that the British made in the 1920s. But by the time Britain went into Iraq in 1920, Britain was effectively broke. Britain owed more money than it had. And we're exactly the same. We owe more money than we have. And we're borrowing money in order to finance the wars that we're fighting now. And where is that money coming from primarily? I'm sorry?
Asian banks
primarily. In fact, The Economist, a couple of weeks ago, the British publication The Economist, looked at this whole situation with money and showed that, every day, basically, the U.S. has to borrow money from Asian banks, primarily Japanese, Chinese. I think there was a third country that they listed. Why do they keep on lending us money? Because they're never going to get that money back. You see, the dollar is falling in value. So if they lend us money, when they do get their money back, it's going to be less money because the dollar's fallen in value. So why do they keep on lending us money? Tom?
They really don't have any choice. They're so dependent on us consuming their goods that if they didn't lend us money, their economy would crash.
Very good answer. In fact, they'd be faced with high unemployment because, you know, people are employed to produce the goods which are sold to America. They want us to keep on buying those goods, and the only way we can buy them is by borrowing money. And we just go along with that. Why do we keep on borrowing money? I mean, why do you borrow money? Why does everybody else borrow money? I assume you do. I mean, unless you're... why do we all overspend? Nathan? But how are we able to get them? Sorry?
Credit cards,
see? You know, most countries don't have credit cards. You know, in Ghanaians, for example, do not have credit cards. You can't get a credit card in Ghana. There's no such thing. You can't even write a check in Ghana. Cash is king, as they say. It's the only thing you can use in Ghana for any transactions. And that's the same in most countries around the world, most African countries, and because people just are not able to borrow. Those countries' economies could not handle it, could not handle borrowing. And when you look at our history, borrowing, on the scale in which we borrow today, is a fairly recent development. When I started work in 1967, now this was in England, which, you know, was a few years behind America in terms of economic development, but in 1967, there was no such thing as credit cards. I worked for a bank, and I got my cash at the end of the month. That was my salary, and that's what I had to live on. Now, if I wanted to buy a house, yes, I could have borrowed money. If I wanted to buy a car, yes, I could have borrowed money. But really, for everything else, I could not borrow money. And so you had to live within your means. Now, I realize for most of you, this is an extraordinary concept, and something that you've never heard about before, but this is the way it was for hundreds of years, or for thousands of years. But we have got ourselves incredibly into debt. It's kind of interesting, too, when you think about everything in the context of Deuteronomy 28, which we looked at briefly yesterday, and we'll look at more today and tomorrow. But when you look at Deuteronomy 28, the blessings and cursings, you realize that the more we break God's law, the bigger the mess we get ourselves into. And there's one area in particular that ties in with this financial situation, and that is the breaking of the Sabbath. I remember when it was first proposed that stores be allowed to open on Sundays. Now, keep in mind, as I've said a number of times, that, you know, from the time of Elizabeth I, when the Protestant Reformation was secured in England, and that led to the development of the colonies in what is now the United States. From that period of time, there was an incredible enthusiasm for the Bible. And remember, Jacques Barzun, the historian, said this enthusiasm for the Bible lasted for 350 years. The year 1900, remember, was the first year in which more secular books were published than religious books. So during that 350-year period, you know, people's lives were based on the Bible to the extent of their understanding. Most people did not understand about the seventh-day Sabbath, and so they thought the Sabbath was Sunday, but Sunday observance was very, very strict. And, because they were ignorant, they were not held responsible for the fact that they misunderstood, and, consequently, to a certain extent, that was overlooked. I mean, obviously... we are not ignorant. We know when the Sabbath is, and so it's a different situation with us. But the interesting thing is, when it was first brought up that stores should be allowed to open on Sundays, a lot of comments were made along the lines of, well, there's only so much money out there. You know, if people can buy on Sundays, they'll buy less on Friday, less on Tuesday. So, you know, it's just going to mean the stores will have to pay out more in wages, but we won't get any more business. But we went ahead and opened on Sundays, and it increased retail trade by 15%. 15%. The average family that is in debt overspends by roughly 10% a year. You know, if we kept the Sabbath in this country, if we closed retail businesses down for a 24-hour period, one day a week, it would reduce people's spending by 10 or 15%. We wouldn't have the debt problem that we've got. We wouldn't have the trade deficit that we've got with the rest of the world. So you see how we suffer the natural, inevitable consequences of breaking the laws of God. And the Sabbath is one of the primary laws of God. You look at the Old Testament prophets, And one of the major reasons why Israel and Judah went into captivity was because they broke the Sabbath. Now, it didn't happen immediately. God warned them through the prophets that this was going to happen if they didn't start keeping the Sabbath. It was a long period of time before it finally happened, before the captivity happened, but it did happen. One reason was the breaking of the Sabbath. Another reason was the way in which they oppressed the poor. And really both come down to one word, and that word is greed. And you can see the same in our society today, because money is God. That is the most important thing to most people in our society. From my own experience, I would say I think that is the biggest single reason why people sometimes reject the truth of God and leave the church. It is because they want to work on the Sabbath, or they just for some reason want more money, and they're pursuing material things rather than pursuing God's truth. And so that is a major problem in our society today in the Western world, and especially here in the United States. So breaking God's law has led us into this problem with finances. Can you think of any other laws that we've broken that have led us down this path too, to where we've got these financial problems? Because there's another major area where we've created this problem. We've brought it upon ourselves. That's what I'm trying to say here. Yes?
The abortion thing has taken so many of our people. What would have been our own pocket?
Okay.
And now it's all been replaced by people from other countries.
Yeah, that's right. That's one. How does that... See, that does create a problem, because many people who come from other countries send back money to help their families in those countries. In fact, it's very common in Ghana for people to try and send one member of their family to the U.S. That one member who comes here may not earn all that much, but he sends back a significant percentage of his income to take care of his family in Ghana. So, yeah, that's very much a case. Yeah, Lindsay. Yeah, the seven-year land rest, that's another contributory factor, and we've already seen in the prophecies how God wants to give the land a rest, and that's one reason for captivity as well. That's a good point. Gary?
Going along with what you say about people sending money back to the nation they've come from, it's actually worse than that, because I wonder if the government has a special program for foreigners to come in and buy a business. They can 5 years tax free. These include two great hotels and one by
India. Yeah.
And what happens is they buy the business, 5 years later they sell it to a relative, 5 years later they sell it to a relative, so that business stays in the family for 20, 25 years, and they pay $0 in taxes.
Yes. Yes, that's true. In fact, I had next to the plane on one flight I was on, I had an Indian businessman telling me the secret of their success was that 75% of their business was in cash, which they didn't declare, which is interesting. See, that, different peoples operate in different ways, and that's their way of operating. Richard. That's the one I was looking for, actually. The breakdown of the family has been a major contributory factor here to our indebtedness, because that costs money, and it costs government money. Let me tell you a little bit about England here, because I've got five brothers in England, and they've got kids, and I've got cousins and everything, and I think England perhaps is worse than the U.S. in this respect. But in England, if you're a female age 15 or 15 plus, and you've got problems with your parents, there's an easy solution: you get pregnant. You don't need a husband, you just get pregnant. If you're a single mom with a child, then automatically you're entitled to your own apartment. And the state then also will give you a regular amount of money each week just to take care of all of your needs. They even, will buy you furniture, buy you even a color TV, refrigerator, dishwasher, and the whole works, because, you're entitled to that at the age of 15. So if you've got a problem with your parents, it's a simple solution. You just get pregnant. But, the state pays for everything. And, of course, the taxpayer has to pay for all of that. Then there's other things, too. I've got my nephew, for example, my brother and his wife divorced. And my nephew kind of went off the rails a little bit. And at 18, he was able to get an apartment because he left home and became a student. He's a full-time student. The whole cost of everything is paid for by the government. And, you know, he has a girl living with him. So, you know, she's also getting money because she's a student. So the two of them together are living extremely well in an apartment. And there is they don't have to work at all, not even an hour a week. Everything is taken care of. I can see some of you filling out the immigration forms for Britain right now. But it's a very generous program if you're a student. And, you know, my nephew was telling me about this when I was there just before the feast. And I said, well, you know, I said, really, when you think about it, I said, government really is stupid, isn't it? And he agreed, it is. You know, but, you know, you'd be stupid not to take advantage of it, too, you know. And that's what he's doing. Al. Yeah. Yeah, I might just add a little bit to that too, because, you know, today our money is not backed by anything. It's as Al said, it's not backed by gold. Our money used to be backed by gold. You could, in theory, take American dollars into any bank around the world and exchange it for gold. And so the currency had a real value. Today it doesn't. No currency does. And the Economist, at the launch of the euro a few years ago, made the point that history shows us that all paper money eventually fails. Keep that in mind. Paper money eventually fails, eventually collapses. There's another thing, too, I might add regarding the finances. You look at AIDS, for example. We have a church member in Lansing who works with a federally funded AIDS program. And, you know, anybody who is HIV positive is taken care of in every respect. As this individual told me recently, he said that you know, he can't afford dental care for his children, and yet anybody who is HIV positive gets it immediately free. You know, we have a very powerful lobby that is helping you know, people with AIDS. And you know, he said also that they're not allowed to ask if anybody is a citizen or even if they are legally resident in the U.S. So people are coming from all over the world. He mentioned specifically people coming from Africa to Southwest Michigan, where he is working. And they're coming from all over the world because they've heard that when you get here, if you're HIV positive, you're taken care of. And all your needs are taken care of because we have this very powerful lobby. Now, the cost of looking after somebody with HIV, you know, all the pills and everything is, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. In fact, probably now that those medications can make you live longer, we might even be talking over $1 million per person. And, you know, this is another thing you see. I'm not saying that everybody with AIDS has committed sin, because some have gotten it through blood transfusions or something, but, you know, it began with sin. And it's the consequences of it that we're suffering now, and this rising bill which has to be paid, and it's paid by the taxpayer. Or we're borrowing the money to pay for it, you see. Yeah, Greg.
I don't think we can forget about, as you pointed out, what's happening in England. We're having the same thing here in the United States with our welfare system. People just need to have multiple children and their income goes up. Of course, that income is all free income. None of that income is taxed for them.
Yeah.
And along with that comes food stamp program.
Right. And the situation gets worse because the bill each year, what the government has to spend for all these programs increases every year. So the situation just getting worse. Eventually it would just lead, you know, to a total collapse. Now realize we have come in 150 years from an era in the middle of the 19th century were if you got into debt and you could not pay your bills, you went to prison. They had debtors' prisons. If you read any of Charles Dickens's books, debtors' prisons feature. And there is a debtors' prison still preserved in London, England, if you want to go there and have a look at it. But if somebody got into debt, the family would have to go to the prison. The whole family would go. The man would have to stay in the prison all the time. But during the day, the wife and children could go out of the prison and make money to pay off the debt. But the man was not allowed to go out until the debt was paid off. And again, debtors' prisons lasted for hundreds of years. Today, you know, we're encouraged to get into debt. I mean, we actually have all these commercials on TV wanting us to get into debt. And, you know, if you've got your own house, you'll be getting credit card offers every single day just trying to get you more and more into debt. Nathan?
I just wanted to give the reason why Dickens wrote about debtors' prisons. His father had been in one.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Dickens lived in fear of that all of his life, of financial problems, and, you know, that was the way people were back then. So things have changed a great deal. So let's just look at Deuteronomy 28 here and just go through it for a few minutes. Now, it shall come to pass, verse 1 here, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. That's exactly what happened. When we look at the way the United States and Britain were, you know, we were set high above all nations of the earth. We obeyed the voice of the Lord our God to the best of our knowledge and understanding as a nation. The laws of God were based on the Ten Commandments. Remember, it was in the time of King Henry VIII that the Bible was first legalized in English. And I showed you a couple of weeks ago the incredible enthusiasm with which the Bible was received. And, you know, this led to people reading Bibles just about everywhere. And as Benson Bulbrick wrote in the book Wide as the Waters, the English took the Bible with them everywhere, and that included the American colonies, and the American colonies were founded upon the Bible as the Word of God. In 1644, I think it was, the colony of Massachusetts became the first colony to provide what we today would call public schools. It was schooling provided for the children in the colony of Massachusetts. And the reason why they started public schools was because it was felt that if children could not read the Bible, then there would be anarchy. There would be a breakdown of civil rule if people could not read the Bible. So the specific purpose for introducing public schools was the children needed to read the Bible. Now, later on, in the 1850s, I think it was, in New York State, after the United States had been formed, in New York State, with people moving to the cities from the countryside with industrialization, there was a similar fear. The fear was that these children now moving to the cities were not receiving the spiritual instruction that they received in church and Sunday school when they lived in rural areas. And this is when the United States began free public education, public schools. And again, they were begun specifically with the intent of teaching children the Ten Commandments. Because without the Ten Commandments, there would be, again, a breakdown in society. And then, by the way, Catholic schools started just after that, because the Catholic Church did not want its children learning the Protestant Ten Commandments. Because if they learned the Protestant Ten Commandments, their immortal souls would be at stake. So they had to start Catholic schools to make sure they only got the Catholic Ten Commandments. Remember, the Catholics don't have the Second Commandment, which says you shall not bow down to any pagan idols, for obvious reasons. And they divide the last commandment, you shall not covet, into two. So they have a different list of commandments. So, you know, that's the amazing thing is, though, of course, today people believe that religion should be kept out of schools. But the reason for starting them in the first place was to teach religion. Harvard was founded in 1636 as a school of divinity. You know, it's just interesting when you look back. Oxford University in England, where John Wycliffe was a pupil, and then later on, he was a student, and then later on a professor there, Oxford University in the 1300s, people went there to learn the Word of God, and it was a school of divinity, and later on, of course, it expanded to provide other things as well. But these institutions now are the institutions which are leading the campaign to just persecute Christianity. There's a very good book on this you might want to have a look at sometime. It's a new book called Persecution by David Limbaugh. And I've been reading it, and it is on how the courts in the United States are persecuting Christians. And, you know, most of what's in there, of course, is very applicable to mainstream Christianity. I mean, he gets into how the courts are even stopping the celebration of Christmas, you know, which he sees as an anti-Christian stance by the courts. But a lot of what's in there is also applicable to us. And it's a very good book, but it shows as well just how everything has changed in the last 40 or 50 years. I refer again to Peter Hitchens' book, The Abolition of Britain, in which he showed a contrast between the England at the time of Winston Churchill's funeral in January 65 and England at the time of Princess Diana's funeral in September 1997. In January of 65, when Churchill died, the British people basically still had the same standards. He comments on how when the Churchill's casket passed in the streets of London, men took their hats off because this was a sign of respect. When Princess Diana died, you know, people just dressed however they wanted to. They were very casual. You know, men don't even wear hats anymore. And just a different approach, even little things like that. But, you know, he showed that by the time of Princess Diana's death, it was a nation of people addicted to their therapists, who were emotional basket cases, just like Princess Diana herself was. But back in 1965, you had these people who really believed that, you know, the British Empire was a good thing, and they were loyal to their institutions that went back hundreds of years. It all changed in one generation. The same with the United States as well. Alex. Well, it's interesting. I'm glad you brought that up because it reminds me. I mean, one of the things that is often quoted by the secularists, those who are trying to attack Christianity all the time, is they will say the Constitution guarantees separation of church and state. And, you know, it's a misinterpretation of what exactly was said. You know, England had an established church, the Church of England. In fact, it still does. So one church was favored over all others. And when America was formed, it was a deliberate decision that the federal government should not favor one religion over others. And that was what that was referring to. There should be freedom of religion. But what is often overlooked, in fact, it's always overlooked by the secularists, is that the day after it was decided, the First Amendment was passed, the day after that, Congress called for a national day of prayer the day after that. And so obviously they were not intending freedom from religion. It was simply that there should be freedom of religion. And of course today it's misinterpreted and is being used by some of these people to really persecute those who have religious convictions. I can't see who it is, but I see a hand up.
Favor of letting the gays marry,
how do you think that will impact attitudes towards us in the rest of the world when same-sex marriage is acceptable, or when it's happening all the time? How do you think it's going to impact us? Daniel? Sorry? Yeah, there will be, I mean, I can tell you now, you know, this will be a major talking point when I go back to Ghana in April. The fact that there's been a lot of these marriages taking place, because it's on the news all over the world, thanks to satellite TV, thanks to radio, and, you know, they know about all of these things, and they'll just say, how can America let this happen? In fact, one of our pastors made an interesting comment. This is in Ghana. I was there when, I've forgotten which court it was, but a court in the southwest decided that the expression under God in the Pledge of Allegiance was unconstitutional and should not be used. I've forgotten exactly the details. But when he heard this on the news, he just looked at me and he went, huh. He said, if America is kicking God out of its schools, then God is going to kick America out of his way. Very simple logic, but it's true. Ties in with the Bible. That's exactly what Deuteronomy 28 says in different words. But sometimes it requires an outsider to see it more clearly than we see it ourselves, because, you know, we become a very complacent people and, you know, a very apathetic people. And, you know, the silent majority in America, if it is the majority, really doesn't stand up for what it believes. And so we get these changes and we just accept them and we yawn and we carry on and, you know, watching Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or whatever the latest show is. Terry.
I think when something like that happens, if they do accept gay marriages in the United States, that's just going to give the Arabic world a bigger reason to go out and do more terrorist actions, because they're going to say, look, we're allowing all this to happen. You know that this is wrong. But the sad thing about it is that sooner or later, our ideas and our actions tend to migrate across the water. You have other countries end up doing the same things we're doing.
That's true. Although sometimes it also works the other way around. Sometimes other Western countries change things that spread to here. I mean, when I mentioned that book that showed that the contrast between Churchill's funeral and Princess Diana's funeral, the changes really began in a big way in the 1960s. In fact, there is a book out now called 1964, The Year That Changed America. And it's interesting that 1964 is chosen, because when I first saw the title, I've not read the book and I don't know who it's by, but when I first saw the title, I thought, why doesn't he say 63? Because that was the year JFK was assassinated. So he was assassinated in late November, so you've only got like 5 or 6 weeks before January. Why 1964? And then I realized why 1964. Anybody like to comment? Why 1964? Al? Well, LBJ was a factor, yes, but if you've been watching the news the last few weeks, you'll know that this month was the 40th anniversary of a social phenomenon. Aaron? The Beatles coming to America. And that was a major turning point. Now, of course, it's a number of different things coming together, but the Beatles brought about a considerable change. And it wasn't just the Beatles, obviously. After the Beatles, you had the Rolling Stones and the Who and all the other rock bands that came out at that time. There was also another significant change in the 60s. In 1960, the birth control pill was invented. That's when it first became available. And so, you know, that led to a sexual revolution. Sex became a recreational activity. And that's how it, you know, first became in the 1960s. Before then, people were afraid to commit fornication because they were afraid of getting pregnant. But the birth control pill changed all that. Now, in 1964, in England, and let's understand, getting back to Terry's comment, England and America influence each other considerably. A development in one soon impacts the other, and either one could be the one that starts the trend. But in 1964, in October, Britain ended 13 years of conservative government and got a Labour government. That's a socialist government, which was a great reforming government, or deforming, depending on how you look at it. But that government, in the 5.5 years in which it was in office, that government, it was two governments actually, because they had another election in 66, but that government changed a lot of things. It abolished the death penalty. It legalized abortion. It legalized homosexuality. Eventually, just after they were out of office, no-fault divorce came in. But a number of things, you know, came in at that time. I'm missing one. I can't remember which one it is. But a number of changes came at that time. Those changes all spread to the U.S. Oh, the other one I missed out was the legalization of pornography as well. Joshua. That's right.
They were afraid of them to go to war. And Britain wasn't even in the whole thing. It was, they weren't even included. It's kind of like U.S. and Russia, two big powers.
Yeah, the Cold War. And that was important, but sometimes these social changes impact a country far more. In the context of Deuteronomy 28, you know, that is more applicable. So let's get back to Deuteronomy 28 because we want to make some progress here. All these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. Blessed shall you be in the city, blessed shall you be in the country. In other words, you'll have peace. You'll feel safe. You'll feel secure in the country. You'll feel secure in the city. Blessed shall be the fruit of your body. You know, you'll have lots of children, in other words, which is always a blessing when you look through the Old Testament. Now, you know, we've changed our thinking on that. And we tend to think that, you know, only having two kids is the right way to go. But the rest of the world still wants 8, 10, 12 kids. The produce of your ground, the increase of your herds, the increase of your cattle, and the offspring of your flocks. This is the blessing for obedience. Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Blessed shall you be when you come in. Blessed shall you be when you go out. You know, I can still remember when people didn't lock their doors. They just would leave the house and just go out and come back again, and nobody had any fear of anybody breaking in. But I think now you'd have to be crazy not to lock your door for most of the time. The Lord will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before your face. They shall come out against you one way and flee before you seven ways. And during our, you know, time of ascendancy, of preeminence, that's the way it was. The Lord will command the blessing on you in your storehouses and in all to which you set your hand, and he will bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. The Lord will establish you as a holy people to himself, just as he has sworn to you, if you keep the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways. Then all peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you. And that's really the way it was. And the Lord will grant you plenty of goods, and the fruit of your body, and the increase of your livestock, and in the produce of your ground, in the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers to give you. The Lord will open to you his good treasure, the heavens, to give the rain to your land in its season, and to bless all the work of your hand. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. And the Lord will make you the head and not the tail, so we would be in control. You shall be above only and not be beneath. You'll be on top, in other words. If you heed the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today, and are careful to observe them, so you shall not turn aside from any of the words which I command you this day, to the right hand or to the left, to go after other gods to serve them. So don't deviate from God's law. Now look at verse 15 and see the curses, the disobedience, the reverse, the punishment. It shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city. Cursed shall you be in the country. Now you'll see as we go through this, some of these things are already applicable. But they're going to get worse. If we have time, we'll look at Leviticus 26, where God says he will keep on turning up the heat seven times. So things will just get worse and worse the further we move away from God's law. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Cursed shall be the fruit of your body and the produce of your land. Cursed shall be the fruit of your body. If any of you saw Pam Stenzel's presentation, you know she covers that without getting into the scriptures. But, you know, today, I saw on CNN a couple of days ago, it said that half of the teenagers in the U.S. at this time, right now, will have an STD by the age of 25, a sexually transmitted disease, by the age of 25. A third of those sexually transmitted diseases are incurable. One, of course, HIV, is fatal. There's two or three which can lead to infertility, which is becoming a major problem in our society. Curse shall be the fruit of your body. You know, you're not going to be able to reproduce. And when you can't reproduce, what happens then? You have to bring in the peoples from Gentile nations to do the work and to fill the gap. The result is eventually you get taken over and there is no Israel anymore, which is exactly what's happening in all the Israelite countries, in all the nations of Joseph. Not one of the nations of Joseph by the end of this century will be dominated by people of Israelite stock. Not one, based on the demographic trends of what is happening, including England. I met with friends yesterday from England. Their area of London is now 51% either first-generation immigrant or second-generation. And they were telling me, much to their amusement, of how in stopping to talk to somebody on the street, the person asked, well, where is your accent from? And they said, well, actually, we were born here in London. And the people hadn't heard a native London accent because, you know, nobody's left. See, you know, and that's the change in 50 years. And that's what's been happening in our societies. Curse shall be the fruit of your body, the produce of your land, the increase of your cattle, the offspring of your flocks. We're going to start and have diseases. We've been breaking God's law. We've been feeding cattle, for example, animal protein when they shouldn't be eating it. As a result of that, we've got mad cow disease, you know, which can stay in your body for about 20 years before it finally gives you a problem. The first sign is it turns your brain into a sponge. Some of you need to get checked out. Cursed shall you be when you come in, and cursed shall you be when you go out. You know, again, you won't be safe. The Lord will send on you cursing, confusion, and rebuke in all that you set your hand to do, until you are destroyed and until you perish quickly. You see, in one sense, it's a slow process, this decline, but eventually the collapse comes quickly, and there are scriptures that show just how quickly, which if we have time we'll turn to. Because of the wickedness of your doings in which you have forsaken me. It's because of breaking the laws of God. The Lord will make the plague cling to you until he has consumed you from the land which you're going to possess. But we're going to have some of these sicknesses come back, new ones perhaps too. Who knows? I mean, some of this has not yet been fulfilled. The Lord will strike you with consumption, with fever, with inflammation, with severe burning fever, with the sword, with scorching, and with mildew. They shall pursue you until you perish. Your heavens which are over your head shall be bronze. The earth which is under you shall be iron. You know, we're going to find we're not going to get the rain as we did. We're going to have climatic changes. In fact, we've already seen that. Maybe the greenhouse effect. Just go further down in verse 25. The Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You shall go out one way against them and flee seven ways before them. And you shall become troublesome to all the kingdoms of the earth. That last part, I think, is very true even now. You know, how much support did we have in this war in Iraq? Only two other countries supported the U.S. fully, Britain and Australia. Only three countries actually sent troops for the fighting. Some other countries afterwards sent troops to help out with the policing. Poland, Spain, you know, Italy, one or two others, but they just sent a token force, but only three countries were actually involved in the fighting. Compare that to the first Persian Gulf War in 1991, when we were able to put together an alliance of, if I remember correctly, 37 nations that contributed troops for the fighting. You know, we've become troublesome to all the kingdoms of the earth. A lot of countries don't want anything to do with us because they're afraid that if they're close allies of the U.S., they'll become victims of terrorism themselves. So they're distancing themselves from the United States. Your carcasses shall be food for all the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth. Well, again, some of these things still in the future. In verse 33, a nation whom you have not known shall eat the fruit of your land and the produce of your labor. This is talking about those that, you know, come in as, you know, we are not reproducing ourselves. So we, you know, having all these millions of people, 3 million people a year move to the U.S. 3 million. Lou Dobbs recently had an article in U.S. News and World Report showing that, based on present demographic trends, by the year 2020, so that's that 16 years from now, we will not be producing enough food for ourselves. And right now, one of the two things that we sell a lot of overseas to make the money to buy the things we like to buy is food. But in 16 years, based on our present demographic trends, we won't have enough food. You know, we're not thinking sometimes about some of these things. A nation whom you've not known shall eat the fruit of your land and the produce of your labor, and you shall be only oppressed and crushed continually. In verse 37, you shall become an astonishment, a proverb, and a byword among all nations where the Lord will drive you. You know, people will talk about what's happened to America and to England and other countries that at one time were so great. Verse 33, the alien who is among you, that's an expression meaning the Gentile, those who are not Israelites, the alien who is among you shall rise higher and higher above you, and you shall come down lower and lower. He shall lend to you, but you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail. And this is what we're going through now, because you know, we've allowed ourselves to get so much into debt that now we've had to borrow from Gentile nations, and you know, they're going to be dictating to us you know, what we can do with that money and what the terms are. Moreover, all these curses shall come upon you and pursue you and overtake you until you are destroyed, because you did not obey the voice of the Lord your God to keep his commandments and his statutes which he commanded you. In verse 49, the Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flies, a nation whose language you will not understand, a nation of fierce countenance, which does not respect the elderly, nor show favor to the young. Go further down, verse 16. Moreover, he will bring back on you all the diseases of Egypt, of which you were afraid, and they shall cling to you. And verse 62, you shall be left few in number, whereas you were as the stars of heaven in multitude, because you would not obey the voice of the Lord your God. Strong words. Good time to break.